So Jerry, WAF is so 90s. I don't know about you, but
give it a new Gartner acronym, but it's gonna be the same exact damn thing.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. I'm your host, Jerry Perullo, with Sunil Yu and Mario Duarte, as always. Good to see you guys. Quick preview. We have a full plate, as usual. We're going to get into some of the tech weeds like we always do. InfoStealer, have to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about those DDoS attacks against X and deconstruct it from the security practitioner's viewpoint a little bit. Some WAF stuff. And we're going to wrap up the episode today with some new breaking news on the CISO job market and debate how valid that is. So good to see you guys. What's going on? Mario, what have you been up to? Are things going well over there on the West Coast?
Well, I just got back from a trip in the East Coast, in Boston. So I was at Secure World. So I was in a plane 6 hours one way or 1.5 hours on the other. I just got back last night.
How about you, Sunil? What's going on?
Enjoying being home, but it's a brief respite. I'll be back on the road for about 7 weeks straight.
Oh, jeez. Wow. How do you do it, man? Sorry to hear that, but I hope you enjoy it. Well, good. Hey, kicking off. Well, you know, one of the things we were talking about is a new twist in the Stealer. Now I realize that it's called Stealers, Info Stealers. You just call them Stealers. In the Stealer saga, so it's been a plague in the cyber industry for a while, and just for the uninitiated, that is malware sitting around looking at browser sessions, looking at the little SQLite databases that underpin browser credential store, et cetera, figuring out your bookmarks, names, and passwords, ripping them, dumping them, and sharing them on Telegram with other baddies, where it says username, colon, password, @, and where it's useful. And then people have been repackaging it and all of that. So Stealer's hosted on GitHub. Sunil, I think you're the one who brought this to light. What's the twist here?
Yeah, so what's actually really fascinating about this is that the delivery was done through malvertising. And think about this in some respects. Let's suppose you are an adversary who wants to target very specific individuals in various communities. Let's pick males, ages 25 to 35, who have a background in mathematics and lives near Columbia, Maryland. Gee, I wonder what that community might be. Oh, by the way, I should say male and females, too. I'm sorry for the ladies out there. But that's
well,
it.
If you were an adversary targeting, you know, it's hypothetical, so who knows what kind of
actually,
biases you have.
You know what? They'll pick males because they're more gullible than the women. So anyway, the perspective here is that if I were to be targeting a very specific community, then what better mechanism than advertising to do that, right? And what's also really fascinating about this mechanism is if you're a researcher trying to recreate the same scenario, you would never see it because you don't fit that demographic. I'm surprised that this hasn't been taken advantage of more frequently, because if I am trying to be a lot more stealthy and very targeted, then what better mechanism than advertising, since that's already a key mechanism that we use that's been successful. You know, there's a huge market. Google's revenue is largely based on ad targeting, and so you can imagine that these are really, really well-refined algorithms that deliver content to a very specific audience. And if you wanted to do that targeting, what better mechanism? And so that was what I thought was particularly fascinating about this InfoStealer attack. Now, I don't know to what degree they've fine-tuned their demographic, but you can imagine if I wanted to steal from a very specific audience or a specific group, that this is the channel to do so.
Wow. And the malvertising was embedded in streaming videos? Is that...
You're right. So it was an iframe that was embedded in some of the... not just streaming videos, but illegal videos. But that's kind of missing the point. It's pirated, pirated streaming. But to a large degree, I think that's kind of missing the point. The advertising ecosystem is pervasive. It's not just tied to this streaming website. If you think anywhere where you go, much of our browsing environment is full of ads. even if you have blockers, there's still lots of ads that still get through. And ultimately, the point is that it becomes a delivery mechanism for it becomes a mechanism that you can be co-opted by an adversary to deliver precision targeted content to a very specific demographic.
So this is going to seem unrelated, but you just got me thinking. So given that advertising can be delivered through iframes or whatever, but in illegal pirated content, seems like a bit of a tension there, right? I mean, doesn't that set up an incentive to have more illegal pirated content if you're delivering advertising through it? Not even malvertising.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you're trying to draw eyeballs. But that's, again, I think the challenge here is, rather, I wouldn't be too caught up in the fact that this is just within a specific pirating website. And it's certainly there's a certain audience that goes to those things. But if you think broadly on how do you co-opt the advertising ecosystem itself, that is what I think would be of particular concern. So a part of the question then is, what controls does the advertising ecosystem have to ensure that certain content doesn't get delivered to certain, that there's nothing malicious, right? And maybe so there's some controls there, maybe there's not. But that's, I think, part of the concern that I would have here.
This reminds, it's not similar, but it technically reminds me of something where I used to work for a company that was a competitor of AWS a decade or a half ago, just before I was Snowflake. And my team identified a campaign where a website, normal website, some vendor website, would wait for the visitors to come in, and they were looking for a specific client on a browser, a specific client running on a specific either iOS or operating system, whatever that was the case at that time. And what they would do is if they found the vulnerable one or what they were targeting, they would advance to a different site. And you have security teams that are going in there and they say they have a patch version of this browser or a patch version of the iOS. And they would go to look at the site and, maybe they shouldn't. But anyhow, in those days, we did. And so we look at it and we say, well, this is a normal website. There's nothing on it. And it turns out that this suspect site was just looking for the vulnerable systems and advanced go to the bat website, which then downloaded the malware. If you weren't impacted, you would go to the clean, real website with no malware. And so it kind of tripped us a little bit. I don't know if this is similar to what you're talking about here, but I can keep selecting your target. At a high, now you're using marketing site to know a specific target group that you want to go after. It's interesting. So the vulnerable person is not the machine, but it's the person you're targeting.
Exactly. Quite honestly. Well, at some level, it is tied to the machines representing the demographic of the user, right? And that also means that if you happen to move with your laptop somewhere else, it's actually still your demographic is moving with your system, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is a recurring theme of targeting. And like to your earlier point, you said something like you're surprised that more of this isn't happening. But I mean, I guess the point is you don't know. Mm-hmm. You don't know if it's not happening. That's the whole point, right?
That's right.
I mean, it's just like another variant of this was geo-based attack redirection, right? Where anyone who scans, I remember this in takedowns and in brand infringement, right? A lot of us in enterprises would pay a lot of threat intel providers to originally look for typo squat domains. And then when I got more sophisticated, it said, let me look for sites that are hosting content that looks like your brand, which is really cool. But what we then found was that a lot of that stuff was geo-fenced. So it's like it's going to show you your brand if you're in Europe, but if you're in the States, it's going to show you a domain parking page, right? And so a lot of those companies had to pivot to scanning from a lot of different egress points. And if you do that, I bet a good alarm, you don't have to bother analyzing content anymore. If you just notice a major diff or targeting, that alone is a red flag that something's going on. Mm-hmm. So who knows how much of this is going on? Yeah. Watering hole attack, kind of, to some degree, I'd say.
Yeah.
The thing I do want to still consider the pirated video. And it, when I read it, I know I get your larger meta point, Sunil, and I agree with it. But why did they pick this particular, pirated movies? And the first thing I don't know if you guys remember this movie in early 2000s, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. So if you ever look at it, if you remember, so I'm not going to go because it's a little dirty and it's not appropriate for this. But no, it was Guy Ritchie who directed and wrote it. So yeah, it was before Brad Pitt's other version of that. But basically, what ended up happening is in this case, they would target a particular group that was doing shenanigans. They weren't doing good things, right? But in order to get your money back for these shenanigans you were doing, you had to apply, say, can I get my money back? And they would get a check. And then the check had a name of the company and it had a really bad name of what they were doing, right? Like the people visiting these sites. So I think, what does this all have to do with this? I'm thinking you knew you were going to a site that posted pirated movies. Imagine going and telling your IT department, if you were running your own, work, if you were using work laptops, to go, how did this happen? Well, I went to a pirated site or a website with pirated movies, clearly probably violating 1,001 different policies, corporate policies. So you probably want to cover your tracks or maybe not make a big stinker about it or contact your IT department, because they would find out that you were looking at pirated movies.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's a classic. Yeah. All right. Hey, moving on. So, I want to touch for a minute on, one subject here. Our friend Valerie Abend actually was quoted in here with Accenture about a survey around banking in particular, but I think this is true of any large enterprise, saying that basically they can't keep up with AI-powered cyber criminals. More specifically, the social engineering enhancements around deep fakes and voice fakes and that sort of thing. I think that's kind of no surprise, right? If you draw a continuum to me, it will not be possible to use your traditional voice and video things to discern reality from fakes. But I keep going back to, if somebody asks you to jump off a bridge, it doesn't matter who they are, right? I mean, that's got to be the only solution to this, is just double check anything. Is that as simple as it is?
I think you were referring to deepfakes as a concern, or at least one of the concerns that's being brought up. Going back to the movies example, the movie that comes to mind for this one is called Multiplicity. If you've ever remember that one, or if you're, it's more more recently, there's a movie series called or TV series called Dark Matter, based on a book called Dark Matter. But anyway, if you think about those movies or shows, it's not about deep fakes, but it's all about deep fakes. When you have a person that is duplicated and the loved one somehow can't tell the difference between one of the, you have an evil twin problem, and they're basically identical. And I would argue that there's no technology that could distinguish them, right? Exact same memories, exact same irises and biometrics, whatever, even, the same passwords and whatever. So what they ultimately had to deal with, to counter that, they had to come up with a process-oriented control, which is kind of what Jerry's saying. And to be able to thwart technology-oriented deepfakes that where the detection technology is going to ultimately fail, then you need to fall back on process-oriented controls as well.
And I don't see why people are so confounded by that, but, to me, it's kind of a, hey, someone called and said that it was my accountant, and they just wanted to wish me a happy birthday. Do you think they were real or not? Like, who cares? Someone called and asked me to wire him $25,000. Okay, let's stop now. Let's slow down. That seems kind of simple.
Have you guys been, I don't know if you have that in where you guys live, but we have a couple of bridges here in the Bay Area, to say the least. And you don't pay somebody anymore, a person, you don't give them money or at the booth, you just pass Advance Go, they take a picture, and then they charge it to your car. And you have an account, you pay it, right? And if you don't have an account, you'll get some email or something on that. Actually, you'll get in mail that you need to pay this, and it'll show you a picture of your car. I don't know if you've seen this recently, but there's been an uptick in texts, people receiving texts where they say, we noticed that you went on this day, you drove blah, 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 but you haven't paid your bill. Click this link and go pay it. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, so actually Krebs wrote about that, and that one is tied to, it's really fascinating. So there's a Chinese criminal gang that has figured out a way to do, to take credit card information that people put in through those, they get fooled by the text messages, they try to pay, and the credit card that's used to pay then is enrolled within Apple Pay on a physical phone in China, and they found a way to remotely use that Apple Pay NFC to make purchases in other parts of the world. Anyway, that's, you can read about that in Krebs, but that's Krebs on security. But yeah, it's an interesting problem space. Going back to the AI one, though, let me offer a meta way to think about this as well. So organizations should be worried that they cannot keep up with AI-powered fill-in-the-blank. Okay, so AI-powered developers. Okay, so how will, let's as an example, imagine a year or 2 years from now where instead of the current number of pull requests that we see 10 times as many pull requests, 100 times more pull requests. I'm not talking about security issues, just pull requests themselves, right? And now what would you do? You're not going to have human reviewers. You're going to have machine reviewers. So what does that look like? And are we comfortable with a machine reviewing another machine's outputs? That's just an example. But, I think we in security, there's another one that we all hate with a passion. And yet we know exactly where this is going, which is, I just got this third-party vendor's questionnaire. Can an AI system write my answers? Okay. And of course, on the receiving end, can I have an AI system review the answers? Okay, you can see where that's going. But the point at the end of the day, one of the things that a lot of us are struggling with is it's not just AI powered criminals; it's AI powered like SaaS applications and tools, and just the number of systems, things that are coming online that is inundating our inboxes or our ticketing queues around. Can someone review this new thing that we just want to get? It's become untenable for us to do any of that manually. So we have to turn to other AI-powered tools to do that. But I'm not sure how comfortable we are in leaning upon AI-powered tools to do the work that other humans would have otherwise done.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, any place where we've had automation, which is kind of like the order of magnitude smaller stepbrother of AI, we've had the same issue, right? Cotton gin or industrial revolution in general, the Sunil of it goes back in time is like, are you sure we want to automate the distillation industry? We have so much whiskey. What are we going to do with it all? We manage. But no, I mean, it moves the logjam, doesn't it? It moves it somewhere else. And then you have another problem that you need to solve. But at the end of the day, we're trying to get net productivity increase. And can we, when it comes to the third-party questionnaire arms race, as I like to call it, I mean, we all know that when Big Bank X sends out 1,400 questionnaires, they don't even read them when they come back today anyway. Right? Yeah. They probably just screen. Yeah. Or it just says, it doesn't say yes. Just let me know if they said no. So now it'll be AI doing the same. I mean, it's an insincere process already. So if it just gets faster, then great, because it's not going to have any degradation in quality.
I think at this, if somebody keep me honest on this, there were over hundreds of banks that were surveyed on this question. So I do speak with some of the top banks out there, as I'm sure all of us do, and they're really thinking about this problem, and they have, in my opinion, have considerable amount of funds to see how they could combat. What I worry about is the community banks or the smaller banks, regional banks that may not have the technology or the money to be able to combat this. And I think that's kind of my concern.
Well, even more so, then they're going to turn to automation to combat it as well.
Yeah, no, but yeah, that's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, look, the fact is that big companies are outsourcing third-party risk management. And then by the time someone's actually sending a questionnaire, it's very insincere. They don't even know what the product is that's being bought anyway. And now the receiving end is doing the same thing and outsourcing it to people who don't even know what the product does and just shuffling answers in and out. AI on either end of that, it would be an improvement. At least it has a chance of contextually mining some actual data. So
I think it might be an improvement. I think the system is broken when it comes to that. I would agree with you, Jerry. Yeah.
With respect to third-party risk management, one of the things that I've seen some startups do is to say, it's not just let me read the answer and process it, but rather let me read the answer and see if I can externally verify it. Externally, if there's an external observable that helps me verify it. I find that I'm a little skeptical as to how much you can externally verify. That starts the reek of the bit sites and the security scorecards. If they can somehow connect the dots between what you say and the real observables, then we're starting to make some ground.
Before jumping into this other one, but somebody keep me honest, because I just invested some money on a startup still in kind of seed round, and they're looking at this space, which I cannot believe I just invested in this space. But hear me out. It was actually pretty good because they're using AI for this. But and AI and third party risk, and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I must be bored with my life. Anyway, so what they're doing is they're looking at the vendors that they're assessing, and let's say it's a SaaS vendor or some product on the internet, some software product, and they are looking at the documentation provided, the user documentation. So not just the services, not just what they're, scanning for services and what ports they're running, but they actually look at the documentation they provide. And they're looking at things like, what kind of encryption are they suggesting, or MFA with FIDO 2. So they're using AI to read the documentation. They're also seeing if they can look at publicly accessible, customer support comments and community chats about the product to look at trends at how quickly they identify issues and how quickly they fix them. And so now they're looking more, they're using AI, because this would be impossible for a human being, or even if you had a large team, I think. But they're able to use these AI agents to go and peruse all this data and say, is this a company, a vendor that's actually doing what they're saying they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of evaluating the agility of a company if you wanted to test their security. I mean, if you took that questionnaire, 200, 300 questions or more, or the SIG or any of the standardized questionnaire and all of that, and you give me the answers to it, I don't have the time to read that nonsense. It's just not correlative with security in my mind. But anything about agility, are they finding stuff? And when they do, can they fix it? I like. And so, yeah, if you could do some inference on that, I think that's great. I mean, you could do it on the, God, remember the attack we talked about with Bybit last week? Yeah. They discovered it using the Internet Wayback Machine. And right, there were some snippets, the researchers found snippets of the malicious JavaScript at a certain point when the Internet Wayback archived it. And then in the next snippet, which was same day, it was already gone. And it was amazing, like security camera footage that they caught them red-handed. Here's the JS. We totally know they had it in there. But that's awesome agility, right? That's why North Korea won $1.5 billion. And that's the same kind of quality that we're looking for on the defensive side about agility. You can almost use the Wayback Machine just to see how quickly people will change your website. Insurance providers, go for it. All right, guys, now we're going to talk about Elon Musk. Now's the time, the segment where we talk about key controversial political figures. Every week, we're going to do this live here.
Please don't harm my ex. Please, people, don't damage it. It's not my fault.
I didn't know if you meant the message, the social media platform, yeah, or an ex-girlfriend, or if you meant the car. Finally, I got around to
my
he's talking
Tesla
about
it. My Tesla ex, right? Don't damage my Tesla ex, please, people.
Good luck with that. Yeah. Yeah, I hear you live in a neighborhood that might be a problem. Yeah. Now, we're talking about DDoS here, right? This is the cyber place. So first of all, look, this is a good opportunity to talk about denial of service in general. And I think, for one, people use the term DDoS to talk about DOS all the time. The first D is distributed. So when something goes down because it's overwhelmed, people say DDoS. First of all, it might just be denial of service. Distributed denial of service is a different animal. In this attack, so to quick recap it, Twitter had some problems, and Elon Musk said it was related to a cyber attack. And then it went on to DDoS. I saw security researchers, because with big DDoS now, security research groups can substantiate it. Right? They see the packets flying around. Generally, any literal DDoS, there's usually a synchronous or stateful type of DDoS, which is like a layer 7. And that's, hey, we find every time we click this button on your website, it takes 1600 milliseconds. So let's get 100,000 bots to click that button. Those aren't as common. They're not as damaging. They're usually fixed by a WAF or let's turn off that button. And then the big ones, the volumetric, the ones that you hear about in the headlines about X terabytes coming out of wherever, are almost always reflective and amplification attacks.
And DNS amplification attacks, yeah.
Any kind of anything that you send in a packet and pretend it's from Joe, and then the thing sends back a shit ton of packets to Joe, that is real DDoS. So the way that you perform a volumetric DDoS against X, Twitter, whatever it's called, is that you find a bunch of vulnerable devices and you tell them all to attack X, and then they dutifully do it for you.
In this particular incident, I don't know if, I think 5-6 years ago, if this happened, we in the security community would have almost instantly noticed, because a lot of us live and get a lot of intel from Twitter. And I don't know about you, but I don't think most of us noticed, because it was, we're not there anymore. And so I think part of the question as a collect, from the collective question here is, where do people go for security news, like real-time security news nowadays? Maybe LinkedIn, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Reddit, I don't know. But the in some respects, we found a single place where we could go, and everything fed from there, which was Twitter. But now you have to kind of hit multiple places to go find that content, because we've kind of all scattered, right? And it's not really, it's just not centralized anymore. So maybe at some point the community will find or gravitate towards one particular location, and that's where we'll get our latest.
There's a good one. There's one that's really taken on steam. It's the Adversarial Podcast. Finding a lot.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But seriously, where do you go? Where do you go when you're looking for info?
Well, I mean, don't you use ChatGPT? Just ask, tell me about the security events today.
What catches
just
you?
Get that information?
How did you get on Mario's screen when with cyber news? Like, where did you hear about the Bybit hack or whatever?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, but you're talking like real-time news. I mean, that's really kind of what Twitter was good at, which is why a lot of news agencies was on Twitter. You keep an eye on certain, you follow some very specific news feeds, and you're getting like truly real-time content.
Yeah, well, I mean, so you mentioned Mastodon. I know I've seen links to that, and I tried it for a little bit and gave up really fast. I kind of hated the idea that of things being diluted and all over the place, decentralized. Hated that. And for me, it might be embarrassing, but why not? I think it's LinkedIn and Slack. And by Slack, I mean groups, you know, that are like security practitioner groups that have a few hundred people or whatever. That's the main thing for me. All right, the Elon Musk segment of the show is over. You know, another topic here, though, you're changing gears onto BYOL. So a friend and I started calling this whole thing BYOL because we realized when you say BYOD or bring your own device, people assume you mean phones, and it's so confusing, especially for non-cyber execs. So we started saying BYOL, meaning can you access the corporate resources from your home computer? What I've observed time and time again is that in new businesses, so I'm not saying small businesses or young or immature, I'm saying the new generation, which is your IDP, you probably go through Okta and Google or Microsoft, one of those two, SaaS forward, all your emails up there, that at a relatively low maturity level, companies are still saying we're issuing devices. We're buying everybody a Mac or a Windows laptop. Why? Why are they going to spend $3,000 each for security? That's going to come up in there somewhere. So they feel that just saying use your own computer is not very mature. It's kind of embarrassing. Probably can't pass SOC 2, whatever. So they're spending $3,000 a pop. And I'll contend that maybe even the majority, or at least a huge chunk of those companies, the employees have no technical control forcing them to use that device. And they could just log into Okta from their home computer, get to all the exact same stuff, download all the data, put all outside those auspices. And that's kind of a ugly, awkward state people have tripped into until someone tells them about it and makes them aware of it, and then they got to make a call on it. Is that intentional? Or is that okay? Or is this a big gap that everybody needs to figure out how to close?
So let's talk about the problem space in a more systematic way. And what I'll talk about it is different levels of substrate. Okay. So way back, the substrate was, let's say, the network, meaning your presence on the network granted you access to corporate resources. And in some respects, it didn't really matter what device you used, but being on the inside the corporate environment meant that you had access to corporate resources. We, of course, know that that was a bad idea. And so we said, okay, we need to have more secure or assured look devices to ensure that the devices are secure, because the devices live outside of the network as well. So the network substrate was no longer there. Now we say, let's use the device substrate. Okay. But if you think about it, what we actually interact with nowadays most often is a website. Okay. So the question is the device substrate the right substrate to put our security controls on? We understand the network substrate isn't anymore. So if the resource that most of us access is on the web, then should the browser be the substrate that we use to put our security controls on?
Yeah.
That question sets up the notion of enterprise browsers and protected browsers.
Yeah.
I like that. Strongly, at least in theory, and I use that, right? So we've got a little bit of everything here. Now we've got managed devices, we've got CTNA, Cloudflare Warp on them, and then Island, the enterprise browser. And I mean, I literally use it in my kitchen. It's my PC that I'm going to be on there, and then when I walk away, the kids are all going to use that, and I want to feel good.
Yep.
And that works. It's a good idea, because you can configure it to blow everything away and whenever you close it out, and you can configure it to force you to log in, which you can't do with Google with a startup account, with a low-end account. You have to manually log out all the time. When I think about the pushing that into these new companies that I'm talking about, the problem quickly becomes most of them are technology and software companies, and it's not just like one or two people in QA need to try Safari and Firefox and Brave and all that.
Yeah.
It's like half the company. We all do it too. Like, hey, this isn't working right. Hold on, before I even call Mario, I'm going to try it on Microsoft Edge. Right? To pull that away and be like, no, it's only going to work on one browser is really tough. And to convince someone that all the testing on Island or Talon, or I just heard Netskope has one too, I guess now. And they're all Chromium based. The ones I know of are, and the other ones, I'm sure.
They're all Chromium based.
So, I mean, and the theory is that, hey, the testing is fine and valid because it's Chromium based. It's all the same. But you know it's not. I mean, like we grew up doing operational rigor, and you do things like really identical. You don't just say really close, right? So that's going to always be a limiting factor. And I don't know that anyone's really going to have ubiquitous access from just enterprise browsers.
Well, I agree and fully agree on that point. It is really the question of at what level do we feel like that the substrate itself is important for us to secure? And if the answer is we need to secure the underlying substrate, the device, because we need to be able to do some operation across five different browser types, okay, then that's what you have to secure. So you bring your laptop... philosophy falls apart depending upon what substrate that you primarily operate on. And bring your own laptop works if you can be substrate independent with the device. We already know we can be substrate independent with the network. And to a large degree, I can argue that more and more of our digital work life is substrate independent from, again, the device that you're using. Does it matter that you're using a Windows or a Mac nowadays? Not really, right? You can still operate most of what you do just through your browser. That's what I'm saying. The question is fundamentally, what level of dependence do you have on the underlying substrate?
Yeah. You know, I'm on a movie series kick this episode, so I'm going to bring another thing. The series Severance on Apple. So please watch it. The whole idea is you have two different personalities, one that's outside and one that's when you go work. It's a totally different personality. You don't know each of them, et cetera. So there are some things in business that we have to, because of the business and the agreements we have made with our customers, that mandates that we comport ourselves in certain manners, okay, while at work, and use our systems that are supporting the business and the customers. We comport ourselves in a manner that keeps things as secure as they want us to be. We are custodians of their data, as an example. The problem where things where we get a little kind of weird is how you comport yourself at home may not be in alignment with how you comport yourself in business. I mean, that whole severance example. And if those things are not matching as well, do you really want to bring your laptop, your personal laptop, where you're doing whatever you're doing, that may not align with the policy, security policies of your company? Do you really want to bring that laptop into the business world?
I totally agree that that's a critical point, right? And when I've worked with companies on this, one of the default moves, and this is totally true on phones, but even on laptops to a degree, is, well, we'll do posture checking, right? And the notion is, well, we want to make sure that thing is secure, whatever that means. So now you're going to do whatever you want, but make sure it's got EDR or something like that. Now you're talking about managing software on personal devices. Nightmare anyway. But on top of that, I think it's the wrong way to think about it, about whether or not the device is secure. And this is totally congruent with what you're saying, Mario. It's not that it's not secure, it's that it's not ours, right? And people become non grata really fast in the business world. And all of a sudden, that person that you're having some employment dispute with, oh, also, by the way, they've got all kinds of ephemeral, well, not ephemeral, data all over their desk, because every time they opened a Google Doc, it was there. They sync down all the code base, all of that. It's okay, it's John, it's our friend. Not anymore. So if you look at it like that, I mean, the thing is hopefully is even more secure than the company managed devices, but it's not ours. So I mean, I think that's a big deal. And if companies can understand that and get it and say, yeah, it's a risk we're willing to take, then that's great. But I think a lot of them don't, when they're turned on to that, they go, wait a minute, what? Somebody could log in and do that?
And I mean, there are things that we do at home that, again, the behavior might not align. Maybe you have a, I don't know, you're into whatever, and that conflicts with the security policies of your company, that you should not have that kind of whatever that is in your laptop. And if you're bringing in your personal laptop which contains that information, and you're using it at work for work, then you're violating those policies. Does that behavior conflicts with your personal life conflicts with your business life?
So, I mean, I think people, if they're not thinking about that, they need to check that, see if they have more BYOL available than they realize, right? Oh, and by the way, you also get into browser sync and syncing passwords and credentials and bookmarks and all that over to an unmanaged device, so they can be raided by info stealer when they're looking at streaming software with malvertising.
Pirated movies, I gotta compromise
Yeah.
that,
Yeah. Are you going to start being the judge of what people are watching at home? Come on.
I was involved in that once a long time ago. Now I don't want to be involved in
Oh, you
that.
know what, I got a really funny story on that I can't help but share right now. Two, 1990, no, probably 2001. I'm this newly minted director of security, and because this is what I'm doing, I find a what we would later come to call a DLP violation. Someone had sent something sensitive to their AOL account. It must have been the literal first one, or the first one of that magnitude that I encountered. So I let the manager know, and we had a little powwow, and we phoned him up, and the guy was at home. He was, I don't know if he was a day off or whatever it was. And we say, hey, we noticed you sent us your AOL account. We really need to know that it's deleted. So we'll be there in about 12 minutes. We drove to his apartment. Never do that. Never do that. So I remember the guy nervously opening the apartment door, and me and this middle manager walk like across the bong, and the bachelor pad mess all the way back to this guy's bedroom and look over his laptop while he logs into AOL and deletes it in front of us. And we're like, okay, all right. All right, great. Well, we'll see you later. Most awkward situation on the planet. Affidavits are good enough. Yeah, don't do that.
It's an awful experience to go through. And yeah, as you guys were talking about downloading pull requests, and you start noticing all of the weird patterns, and whoa, you're doing it from your laptop, home laptop. What are you doing? What's going on here? And then you knock on their door. You send somebody to knock on their door. Somebody.
It's the worst place. Yeah. That was back before bongs were in vogue too. That was back when that was kind of contraband.
The question is plastic or glass?
Man, nowadays you can't go down the street without getting a secondhand bong in the face everywhere, even here in Atlanta. Yeah. All right. Do you think it's about time that we talk about web application firewalls? Are you guys missing that? Oh yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, this is one that I brought up because I'm kind of a technology believer in web application firewall, right? The idea that you have something in line so that you don't have to count on and guarantee that all your code has proper input validation and that all your third-party libraries that are accepting it, third-party or external code, don't have vulnerabilities and on and on. So you put these things in line and you make sure they can decrypt everything and look for badness, kill it in line. I'm a proponent of that and I recommend those regularly. But I've seen a theme here that I think applies to a lot of security tooling, which is that they're, for the people who have them, the majority, they're not enforcing very many of the rules at all. And they've disabled most of the functionality in it. And or it is not applied to any of the stuff with the sensitive data. It's on their marketing website or whatever, but on the mission critical site that you can't have down or the customers will be all upset, they turn off the WAF or they never put it on there. That's more common than not, I would contend. That's the default state of play. And I think it's indicative and illustrative of a pattern with security tools and why, despite the fact that every week we hear about the solution to everything about security and have for the last 15 years straight, that we're still in no better of a place, right? I think the stuff is just too complicated. Everything gets turned off pretty quickly. It becomes a checkbox exercise. Do you have a WAF? Yes, we do. On that questionnaire we talked about earlier, but they're not actually doing anything. And if you want to make one work, it's a full-time job. It's complicated. It requires a lot of testing. You really have to be dedicated to it. And it's pretty thankless, right? Because you're proving a negative. So I think, you know, WAF is just an example of something that if people want to take it seriously, they've got to study that thing and dig in and audit it and do it again every 30 days. You know, is that a pattern that you guys see?
So, Jerry, WAF is so 90s. I don't know about you, but
give it a new Gartner acronym. But it's going to be the same exact damn thing.
No, so let me just tell that same story again, but do it with modern day issues. Okay, exact same story, modern day issues. Hey, I have this application. It has some AI model in it, and it seems to be biased. Okay. Is there some firewall that we can put in that removes that bias, removes these vulnerabilities of our model? And you would say, oh, yeah, here's a firewall. Just throw that in and voila, it works out of the box. Wait, hold on a second. No, it doesn't. Because what do you mean by biased, right? What you mean by biased may be different than what another organization may mean by biased. The nature of what you're doing from a business standpoint is oftentimes very bespoke and very specific to a business function that a one-size-fits-all rule set just does not work. And so when we put in a firewall, whether it's a web application firewall or an AI firewall, we have the situation where we have to really fine-tune it to the use case that we have it deployed for. And if you don't spend the time to fine-tune it to your use case, then it's a piece of crap and you turn it off.
Yeah, I think that's the state of play. Yeah. And I think that, like, we talked last episode about crypto, right? And I'm saying crypto security groups are good. I don't know if we put it this bluntly, but basically because they have to be. And I would argue they're tweaking their WAF or whatever it may be. And that nobody else is? Because they just don't have to? Yes.
Yeah. You know, invariably, through the years that I was a Snowflake, there would be one prospect or customer that would get into some contract negotiations that demanded that we use the WAF. And so I would have a conversation with their CISO and their security team as well. And I'm like, okay, let's talk about this. You know, we talked about TLS decryption last week, or 2 weeks ago for our episode. And, you know, a WAF is going to have to decrypt the data, folks. Okay, this just let's be all right, because it has to look at what's in there. What are people running? What are the commands they're sending? And so you have to decrypt it. So now it becomes one choke point for an attacker to compromise that system, to then start capturing all the data. And you know, you want to have, I don't want to say perfect secrecy, but you want to get to a point where there's not a decryption going on from our client's world to their actual database that we're managing. Okay, so stay with me on that. Okay, so then I would explain to them, okay, so now I'm going to expose your data, which you don't want me to do. You've gone through all this effort to make sure that I don't look at your data, but you're having me do a WAF. Okay, cool. And then, if, you know, I told them, hey, I managed Mod Security years ago. Mod Security was an open source version and then became a commercial version of WAF. Okay, one of the earlier WAFs out there. And we're a database. So there's all these policies and rules, and majority of the rules on these WAFs look like SQL injection or SQL commands. Well, goodness sake, you're a database. You're running against it. You're running commands for a database. Everything we're going to see on that WAF is going to trigger an alarm. And we're going to block it, and then you're not going to be able to work. And so then we're going to prune down your policies that we're using on WAF, our policies, so they really don't defend much. And what have we done? We've exposed your data. Now we can actually see your data. What's the value there? And invariably people will say, okay, you're right. Go on.
It's a trade-off. I mean, I will on other episodes rail on the other side of that and say it's much better to break it and secure it and all that. But I'm not thinking about a massive mega cloud database provider. So I got some sympathy for your unique plight. Well, look, hey, one thing I want to make sure that we talk about that I think people always love to hear about from us is the CISO job market. So I chatted with Matt Commons this morning. A lot of you guys probably know him. He's one of the like top five go-to. Maybe it's financial services bias, but you know, big recruiter. Yeah. And we were just catching up. I was telling him what I was doing, and that I get these calls periodically. Like, are you sure you're out? You know. But I was telling him, like, I got a company here, a startup. I'm all in on that. It's great, but love you like a sister. You know. So while I had him, I picked his brain about the market. So we had mentioned a survey recently and anecdotal observations from CISOs that, man, Eeyore, the things are bad. There's everybody's on the market. There's nobody's hiring and all that. And he basically said things are turning around in the last few months, that he sees a lot more positions. He also noted, and I kind of picked at this, that they're doing recruiting for cybersecurity companies, for like go-to-market personnel. And that was less surprising to me, because that means that the venture market's heating up and there's more cybersecurity people bringing out money and hiring, and they're helping with that. But I was made sure that he was made the distinction. And no, in addition to that, he's seeing the enterprise job listings and comp and all of that, you know, really lighten up. So maybe that's a breath of fresh air. Do you think that's what you're hearing about?
No, well there's the notion of the great resignation followed by the great freeze. So we are in this great freeze part of the market where there are very few people leaving their jobs, because there are not many people who there doesn't seem to be new jobs opening either. So everyone's kind of stuck in their place. But that's it. I have heard, well, there's a lot more people looking, seems like, than there are jobs. I think it'll be a while before it becomes properly operating. There is something that you said, though, that you referred to with Matt, which is there are cybersecurity companies that are also hiring CISO roles, but more on the GTM's go-to-market side. So to me, that translates to like a field role, which, you know, there's a place for that. And for those who want to get away from the day-to-day firefighting, I can see it being a cushy sort of role where you just wine and dine and schmooze people, right? So if you want a break from
the firefighting. But it could spin the data. It could skew the data a little bit.
That's right.
It would. There's more. That's really interesting, yeah.
I'm thinking, I'm like, I don't know if you're familiar, I'm sure you're all familiar with the Schrodinger's theory, you know, where the cat is both dead or alive at the same time. And I think this is what we're experiencing right now when we're talking about this market, really. It's because I would venture to say that we're probably getting hit by the same job break, Jerry, because I've been, so all of a sudden I'm getting calls from, like, you know, hey, you want, there's this job. No, I'm not in the market. I'm not looking for a job. So maybe we're all getting hit with the same thing, the same job, making it seem like it's heating up.
Oh, that's
funny.
It's
the same people,
yeah.
Right? But, and the reason why I'm saying the cat, the live cat and dead cat, is because we're all part of, you know, Slack communities, large communities. And what I'm getting, what I'm hearing, people are not only are CISOs not finding jobs, and those are the ones who are unemployed. So I'll put a caveat there. But ICs are finding it difficult as well. When individual contributors are being challenged, and this is what they're saying, individual contributors are having problem finding security jobs good for them. So maybe, okay, just taking away the funny thing about, you know, being hit by the same job wreck, it could be that there's a delay going on. And yeah, these two things could be happening at the same time, but it's just a wave. Right now, the wave on one end is starting to heat up, but it hasn't really manifested itself for the job seekers. And it might be 6 months from seeing a change. I can't tell, but well, that might be what we're experiencing.
Yeah, and for our peers, I hope that's the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be a bright note.
I'm not looking for a job.
Hey, there's one person who's willing to set their money on fire to have deflation. He's deflating the market for us. Way to go. All right. Well, great. Well, it's fun, guys. It's always great catching up. I look forward to collecting up some more topics that we can go into next time. And Sunil, next time we talk, I bet you'll be on the road somewhere, but safe travels.
Thanks. I mean, I go home on the weekends, but yeah, most of the weekdays will be out and about.
All right. Well, good seeing both of you guys, and I look forward to catching up soon.